Hi, I'm Paul Havershood, host of The Cost of Living. It's a show about money and how it shapes our lives. In big ways, like why inflation could get worse if we all make more money.
Here's the hard truth in all of this. Workers are going to have to eat that real wage loss.
And small ways, like what's the fastest way to order fast food?
That first Big Mac that comes out of the kitchen is going to the drive-thru.
Check out The Cost of Living. We're on CBC Listen or wherever you get podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight.
Not worth the price of emission. Despite what the Prime Minister says, New Brunswick's Premier insists the carbon tax is bad for his province and says he has his own solution to offer.
Class action for Ontario school boards sue big tech companies, accusing them of designing products that change the way kids learn and behave and leaving educators to manage the fallout.
Unacceptable losses. A judge in New York delivers scathing remarks and more than two decades in prison for former cryptocurrency CEO Sam Bankman-Fried.
Tossing a lot more than salad, while some parts of the world go hungry, the UN reports that others are wasting and throwing away a staggering amount of food.
Sharp-witted, fed up with nails puncturing his tires, an Atlanta cyclist constructs a contraption to save his ride and everyone else's. He'll explain why he's getting down to and cleaning up brass tacks.
And while the cars kept a-moving, they kept a-still. Officials at a NASCAR track in North Carolina stumble on a discovery they thought was just a legend, a possible moonshine cave under the stands where hundreds of fans sat. As it happens, the Thursday edition, radio that looks under all that cheering and finds a lot of booze. When it comes to the ongoing arguments over the carbon tax, no one is curbing their emissions, least of all Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. The tax is set to go up on Monday, and Conservative premiers across the country have been lining up to tell a parliamentary committee that Canadians can't afford it. Meanwhile, in Surrey, BC, Prime Minister Trudeau told reporters this.
The premiers, Conservative premiers specifically, are misleading Canadians. The Conservative opposition in Ottawa and Pierre Poilievre are not telling the truth to Canadians. The parliamentary budget officer himself says very clearly that 8 out of 10 families across the country do better with the Canada carbon rebate because we have put a price on pollution.
Prime Minister Trudeau speaking in Surrey, BC. Blaine Higgs is the Premier of New Brunswick. He testified about the tax before a House of Commons committee this morning. We reached Premier Higgs in Fredericton.
Premier Higgs, you heard what the Prime Minister said there. How do you respond?
I think that what's being missed here is the knock-off effects that happen due to higher costs of transportation. So that what we've seen in our country is everything has gone up. Inflation has been an issue, but groceries have gone up. Every commodity we buy, whether it be in retail, stores, everything we see is higher now than it was 2 years ago, or dramatically higher. So that the price on carbon to the consumer, to rate directly at the pumps, and living in a province that's partially populated like New Brunswick, with no, mind you, we have an increase in population. We're up like 60,000 now, but we have no mass transportation system. In other words, we don't have subways and a provincial bus system. So we have to transit by car or by truck. And what's being told here by the Prime Minister is just the one impact about what I pay at the pumps and what's rebated.
Well, what's at issue? Certainly Canadians right across the country know that they're paying more for a lot of things. The issue and what he's getting at, what he says you and the other premiers are doing, are misleading Canadians about the actual impact that the carbon tax is having on all of that directly. He went on to say most Canadians are getting more from the rebate, the carbon rebate, than they're actually paying for the tax. So what do you say to Canadians who appreciate seeing that money arrive in their bank accounts and that rebate and don't want to give it up?
Well, what Canadians are seeing in real terms, to tell the whole story, and I would ask the Prime Minister to do that, is that it's not just about what you pay at the pumps and then what's rebated from what you pay at the pumps. It's about what the cost has increased in every other commodity or aspect of your living. So tell the whole story about the impact. And the Fraser Institute was pretty clear in the impact this has had on inflation and what it's had on everyday lives. So if we talk about the carbon, the liberal carbon pricing, we need to talk about the impacts all down along the chain of the supply chain.
We heard the Prime Minister refer to the Parliamentary Budget Officer. The Parliamentary Budget Officer told CBC News directly last week that when you compare the increased prices resulting both directly and indirectly from the price on carbon to the rebates Canadians are getting back, quote, 80% of households are better off, end quote. Are you disputing the numbers from the PBO?
Well, I think the Fraser Institute already did that. And the idea...
So you have more faith in the Fraser Institute than the Parliamentary Budget Officer?
Probably. But I don't think, I think what that tells you is the confusion in the whole issue in relation to what this impact is having on the country. What we do know is the cost, not only today, of let's say it's 17 cents with the increase in April 1st, but where we're headed here is about a 60 cent increase by 2030 to the price of fuel, 60 cents per liter. I mean, this has a huge impact, and anyone to argue that it has no impact, you know, really look at the whole picture. But I think you know, the point, though, I would like to raise, because the Prime Minister also said that he was looking for solutions.
I was going to ask you about the alternative because he did ask premiers who are upset about the carbon tax to give an alternative. You said today that shipping liquid natural gas to Europe would be the alternative you would pitch. So I wanted to ask you about that, but specifically, do you have a fully costed plan on that or evidence that that would be a viable alternative?
Yes, I do. So some time ago, the Prime Minister stated there was no business case for LNG export out of Eastern Canada. Now, this was the reason that he said that, was because the cost of transportation of gas from Western Canada or from the U.S. was too high. The utility, the pipeline costs and transportation was too high that made the business case viable for Repsol, in this case, to convert their LNG plant. They already had customers, so there wasn't a problem with customer purchasing. It was an issue that the supply cost of gas was too high. And they'd already worked out the cost of refurbing the plant. So the issue, what I'm putting forward here, is that we have a gas supply right here in New Brunswick. We have 77 trillion standard cubic feet of gas in New Brunswick. The same supply of gas, you know, that's feeding an LNG plant out in B.C., and is being developed by First Nations and developers alike. And we would like to do that same thing here in New Brunswick. But we are only 1.5% or 1.8% of world emissions. So my point is pretty simple. We can live in our bubble and say, okay, if we meet our targets, we're doing great. We can do that as well as have a huge impact on shutting down coal plants worldwide by supplying LNG. And for every coal plant we shut down, we reduce the emissions of that plant by 50%.
Do you have the numbers to show that exporting liquid natural gas would actually be a more effective way of cutting carbon emissions, though?
Well, yeah, it's real clear, but we can do both, I guess my point. It's not either or.
Let me ask you another question, Premier. We know New Brunswick's portion of the harmonized sales tax, the HST, is 10%. Would you consider cutting that to help New Brunswickers who are struggling with the price at the pumps?
So, yes, I would consider that, okay. But I have to make a point. Mm-hmm. We are band-aiding flawed policy. So when I say we can provide a solution to meet the requirements, we can debate all day the carbon tax, and I will disagree, and you will give me evidence that others don't. And so, but rather than spend that time, I could bring an affordability growth project here in our province and offset the issues that are affecting New Brunswickers or Atlantic Canadians every day, by introducing, you know, revenue into the system that can deal with the current affordability challenges. So regardless of what happens to the carbon tax, mm-hmm. we can make this a win for the entire province and the emission reduction.
Do you think the political bickering is going to end on this issue, though, as elections, provincial and otherwise, approach? Because you're suggesting that you're willing to come to the table and discuss, but that's not the broader messaging that's happening. So what does that mean for New Brunswickers and Canadians?
I know what you're saying, and maybe it is not, but what I'm saying is I'm offering the Prime Minister a solution that's real. What's happening in other countries any developing country is using its resources to offset the cost of moving to a whole new energy or clean energy environment. And that's all I'm suggesting. Mm-hmm. I'm willing to make that happen, but I need a federal agreement to work with First Nations so we work together in partnership to make this happen.
Premier Higgs, thank you for your time.
You're very welcome.
Blaine Higgs is the Premier of New Brunswick. We reached him in Fredericton. Less than 2 years ago, he was one of the youngest billionaires in the world. He enlisted politicians, athletes, and pop stars to help spread the word as he promised to harness profits from his FTX cryptocurrency exchange to make the world a better place. He was the kind of famous that people knew who you were talking about based on his initials alone, SBF. But this morning in a Manhattan courtroom, SBF, that's Sam Bankman-Fried, was sentenced to 25 years in prison. He was also ordered to forfeit more than $11 billion in assets, roughly the same amount customers lost when FTX collapsed, which led to his conviction on charges of fraud and conspiracy last fall. Elizabeth Lopato is a senior reporter with The Verge. She spoke to Neil about the trial when Mr. Bankman-Fried was convicted, and she was at the sentencing hearing this morning. We reached her in Manhattan.
Elizabeth, take us inside that courtroom, what it was like there this morning. What will you remember about being there?
It was solemn. It was, a pretty heavy experience. Mm-hmm. And I was seated behind his parents with a pretty clear view of them. So that was something that's going to stick with me. That was a rough day for them.
How did they respond?
Oh, his mother, I think, at times appeared to be crying. And they both seemed to have some difficulty once they heard the verdict. They were sort of trying to hold themselves together and not cause a scene in the courtroom, but it seemed to really take a lot out of them.
And the judge really, I was reading your article and others summing up the sentencing, certainly didn't mince words in his response to what he heard from Bankman-Fried.
Yeah, Lewis Kaplan opened, when he was considering the sentencing guidelines by saying that Bankman-Fried had perjured himself at least three times. And then he went on to say that that was not exhaustive of the number of times that he thought that Bankman-Fried had perjured himself. And then he said, and I quote, "I did not think it was a fruitful use of time to spell out every time I thought Mr. Bankman-Fried testified willfully and knowingly, falsely at trial. I've been doing this job close to 30 years. I've never seen a performance quite like that."
And have you ever heard a response from a judge like that in other cases you've covered?
Never. I've never heard anything like it. His testimony was a completely wild experience. And, one of the things that Kaplan points out when he was sentencing Bankman-Fried, is that at no point during Bankman-Fried's testimony did he acknowledge what he had done and say he wouldn't do it again. Mm-hmm. And, he's appealing, so I understand why he's not going to confess to a crime. But one of the things that judges do take into account when it comes to sentencing is whether you've acknowledged that you've hurt people, you've acknowledged your crime, and you're willing to pay for it, and you're not going to do it again. And what Kaplan felt as he was sitting in the courtroom with all of us was essentially that he was going to do it again, and that Sam Bankman-Fried needed to be put away for long enough that he wouldn't threaten anyone again.
As you've been sitting in the courtroom, did you see any change in Sam Bankman-Fried?
I didn't see much. He didn't appear to move much. One of the differences between the sentencing and trial is that at trial, he was allowed to wear a suit. And at sentencing, he was in prison garb. So he was wearing sort of these olive drab khaki outfit. And when he stood up to walk, you could hear clanking because his legs were shackled.
His lawyers, Sam Bankman-Fried's lawyers, argued for leniency because FTX, they said, now holds enough crypto to pay everyone back, which would be thanks to Bitcoin going through the roof in recent months. What did Judge Kaplan make of that argument?
He made a metaphor about Las Vegas. You know, if a thief steals your money and goes to Las Vegas and doubles it and gives you your money back, you still had your money stolen. But the thing that I do want to say about the defense's argument is that FTX didn't have enough Bitcoin, for instance, to return all the Bitcoin to people who it owed. And so what the bankruptcy estate did was they essentially fixed the value of what these people owed as the price of Bitcoin at the time of the collapse. And obviously, Bitcoin was depressed at the time of the collapse. And Bitcoin is now at all-time high. So these people aren't necessarily being made whole, because being made whole would mean they'd get their Bitcoin back.
When we talk about the success of Bitcoin recently, the all-time high just a couple of weeks ago, as we've mentioned, what kind of impact or effect is this whole trial and this saga going to have on the cryptocurrency world? Has anything changed?
I think that the cryptocurrency world is a little more insular than it once was. I think a lot of ordinary people view it with a certain amount of caution. And, like, you know, this particular bull run, I think, was triggered by the ETF, by the approval of the Bitcoin ETF in the United States. And I think that got a lot of people very excited. And I see a lot of excitement within the crypto community. But I don't see a lot of new players. And maybe that will change as this goes on. I don't know. But I do think that the FTX collapse was so big and so astonishing and so hurtful, and it had such huge ripples. You know, two lenders also filed for bankruptcy because of this. It really sort of illustrated how closely interconnected that entire ecosystem is. I don't know. I can't predict the future, but I do think that ordinary people are a little bit wary of cryptocurrency still.
Has oversight changed at all?
No.
Does that surprise you?
No. I mean, the sort of party line from a lot of crypto enthusiasts has been that, you know, Sam Bankman-Fried was a bad apple. He was really a one-off, and nobody else in the industry is like him, and he's not really a crypto guy anyway because he came in from Wall Street. And so I haven't seen any change. I don't know what's going to happen this time. I would be surprised if we don't see something like this happen again. There's a big scam every bull cycle, and I just don't know which one we're going to see this time.
Elizabeth, long trial, long day, I know. Glad we could speak. Thank you.
Thank you. Glad I could make it.
Elizabeth Lopato is a senior reporter with The Verge. We reached her in Manhattan. He calls himself the Atlanta Magnet Man. He is not a spandex-clad superhero who can control magnetic fields or has magnets for hands. But Alex Bonino is doing his part to fight an evil in his community and clean up the streets. Literally. His weapon of choice, his bike. We reached Alex Bonino in Atlanta.
Alex, you've been getting so much attention lately. Are people, you know, calling out to you, recognizing you when you're out on your bike riding around?
Yes, it's really weird having people honk the horn and cheer me on and say wonderful things as they drive past. It's really wonderful.
What kinds of things are they saying?
You know, saying thank you and appreciate what you do. It's really, really uplifting.
It's an uplifting story, and there's lots of love things to love about it. Have people started, you know, officially calling you Magnet Man now?
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty funny. I kind of did it as a sort of a tongue-in-cheek kind of joke. I'd never expected it to blow up, and every time I hear it, it makes me laugh.
Have you been out for a ride today?
Not today, but I'm prepared for when I get off work. I'm going to go up into some nearby roads and do some rides.
Every day you're out there?
Just about, yeah.
Describe your bike and the trailer that's on the back. It's a small trailer at the back, just so our listeners can visualize what you were operating with before you made the modifications, let's call them.
It's a bike from a company called Elliptigo. It's a stand-up bike because I have a bad spine. I had surgery 13 years ago, and I can't sit on a seat anymore. So I found this incredible bike that works. But the main thing is the trailer is universal. It can go on any kind of bicycle.
Yeah.
I had this idea that if I put magnets on the bottom of it, get them as close to the road as I can, I could just pick up nails and screws as I ride so our tires won't have to.
Well, you had a lot of flat tires before you got to that point, right? How many?
Yes. Yeah. So during the lockdowns, I had to drive for work. And that's when I came up with this idea because I got 3 or 4 nails per tire in my car and on my motorcycle. And I realized that it was because that I'm one of the few people on the road that my tires are picking up all these nails and screws that everyone else's tires would be picking up. Since everyone's at home, I guess it was the job of my tires to take care of that. And
but,
I knew, well, there had to be a better way.
There's a lot of magnets on there. These are really strong magnets. You ordered them online, right?
Yes. So individually, they were the least expensive for the amount of power that, and size that they have. So they're like 1.5 inches by 1.5 by a half inch. And I have them all lined up in a row. I'm trying to find the configuration that would maximize the magnetic field. And they can pick up nails as I'm riding at about 20 miles an hour without any problem at all.
How much do you think you've collected so far?
Oh, man. So my first 8 weeks... So, well, in the first 5 months, I was practicing with all these different configurations, and it took me 5 months to pick up 50 pounds. And the latest configuration I have, I picked up more metal in the first 10 days than I did in the first 5 months.
What was the key?
I picked up over 50 pounds.
What was the key to the
configuration? It was the, I added a brush to the front, and that helped loosen the debris, loosen the nails and screws from the road.
Like a broom.
A
broom head.
Kind of like a broom. It kind of gets them moving around and more likely to get pulled into the magnetic field. And then I have multiple rows of magnets because, if it misses the first pass, it'll most likely get pulled up in the second pass.
Is there ever a day when you come back from your bike ride and it's not covered in nails and other kinds of metal?
There's group rides that I do. Mm-hmm. Then we do a lot of the same routes over and over again. And I've been noticing that I'm picking up less and less each time, which is really encouraging that it's working.
Whenever we've spoken about this story as we were preparing for this conversation, people, I'm sure they bring it up to you as well. But what about all the glass?
So I am have a solution for that coming too next week.
Of course you do.
next week, a few months ago, I ordered something called a bike lane sweeper from bikelanesweeper.com, and it's a guy out in California made his own trailer and put a spinning brush on the bottom, and it's battery operated, and so it'll, as I ride forward, it picks up all the glass and gravel and other things that I can't get with magnets, and will dump it all into trash cans in the back. And I just, when they fill up, I pull them out and dump everything out. So I'll be taking requests. But my idea is to do all of the bike lanes around town in Atlanta and get to all the places where the sweeper trucks can't get to because it's too narrow for them to get into the bike lanes in some of the areas.
You mentioned you'll throw away the glass. That's not what you're doing with all the metal you collect. That's a really interesting aspect of the story as well.
Yes. Yeah, so with the metal, I just started collecting it just to see how much I was getting over time and trying to average out the amount that I was picking up. And somebody had reached out to me, a local scrap artist reached out to me, is asking me, what do I do with all the metal? And I didn't have any plans, so I gave it all to her. And she's making some incredible animals out of the scrap metal. I really like her work.
This must just make you feel great on all levels.
It does. I never expected it to go viral. A friend of mine said, hey, you should just post this on Instagram to show people what you're doing. You know, some people might like it. And I never imagined anything like this.
I hear the magnets being ordered right now. It's people getting on their computers as they're listening to this conversation. Have you always been, have you always felt an affinity for MacGyver? Is that someone you identified with?
That was one of my favorite shows growing up, yes.
Yeah. Me too, but I have not done anything like this. Do you hope others pick, we have lots of cyclists, certainly across Canada, but in Ontario and Toronto in particular. Do you hope others pick up what you've done here?
That's my goal, is to share... show everybody what I'm doing, how to do it, where you can find all the parts to be able to do it. Because my ultimate goal is to get all of these nails and screws off the ground so our tires, won't be getting them for us. And I can't do it all alone. I need as many other people as possible to help me.
Alex, a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. This was great.
That was the Magnet Man himself, Alex Bonino, in Atlanta, Georgia. And now for today's As It Happens news quiz. Now, before we start, we've heard your criticisms and we have adjusted. You said our quiz theme was too long and terrible because it was performed by a recorder quintet and it featured a recorder solo. Well, duly noted. Here's our new theme.
As It Happens news quiz.
It's a little tight, but it's fine. We also received a few complaints that the questions were too easy. So today, we're starting off with one that is truly diabolical. Are you ready? I mean, you're not ready, but okay. Question one. This week, officials at a NASCAR track in North Carolina discovered what illegal... Okay, according to our quiz computer, over 94,000 of you just buzzed in at the exact same moment. Of course, you couldn't all have answered correctly. So, no, it looks like you did. It looks like every single one of you said Moonshine Cave. And you're right. Staff were inspecting the grandstand at North Wilkesboro Speedway when they noticed some cracks. And when they started removing seats to check the extent of the damage, they discovered a 700-square-foot area underneath. A secret cavern, which may have been home to the long-rumored Moonshine Still, that was said to operate at the racetrack in years gone by. Now, stock car racing actually originated with moonshine runners who would soup their cars up so they could outrun prohibition agents, your Elliot Nesses and your Boss Hogs. So NASCAR and moonshine do go together like polo and champagne. Nevertheless, if someone was running a moonshine cave under thousands of fans at an actual NASCAR track, that is a bold move. No one could hear them. And if someone saw them, all they had to do was hold still. The quiz is over.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Concerns about the effects of social media on kids have been growing for years, and now four Ontario school boards are pushing back in the hopes of teaching big tech a lesson. Three Toronto area school boards, as well as the Ottawa-Carleton District School Board, have launched a total of $4.5 billion in lawsuits against the companies behind Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, and TikTok. According to the school boards, those companies negligently designed unsafe and/or addictive products, and the schools have been left to deal with the consequences. The Toronto District School Board has filed one of the suits. Costs are being covered by a law firm on contingency. Rachel Chernus-Lynn is the chair of the board. We reached her in Toronto.
Rachel Chernus-Lynn, walk us through why your board believes these companies are financially liable here. How are they costing you money?
In the last number of years, we've seen an increase in change of behaviors among our students. And what we've learned is that social media products have been intentionally designed for compulsive use, for addictive behavior. And they're really rewiring the way children think, the way they behave, and the way they learn. And educators and schools have really been left to pick up the pieces. And what that means is that we've needed an awful lot more things like social workers, guidance support, mental health supports for kids, but also in day-to-day classroom settings, we're needing more educators, more people to help support students We're seeing more impulsive behaviors. We're seeing attention spans decreased. We're also seeing social withdrawal from students. It's very painful to see.
So much has changed and is changing in the world. Even if we acknowledge that social media is having an impact on classrooms and children, how do you know that these three companies are directly responsible for all of those things you outlined?
Well, CAMH did a study recently where they found that 45% of students use social media for 5 hours a day or more. And that's not necessarily during class time. But on top of that, Instagram did its own poll and found that almost 22% of Instagram users aged 13 to 15 stated they were the target of bullying over that product within the past 7 days. That's once a week. That is a shocking, shocking discovery. And as we've learned more and more about the impacts of this and learned more about the social media companies who are aware of the problem and they knowingly have created apps that are addictive and are compulsive, there is a responsibility that they hold to ensure that they don't continue to do harm and that they rectify the problem that they have created.
CBC News has requested a response for the companies named in the suit. A spokesperson for Snap Inc. responded of the three and says Snapchat was intentionally designed to be different from traditional social media. While we'll always have more work to do, we feel good about the role Snapchat plays in helping close friends feel connected, happy, and prepared as they face the many challenges of adolescence, end quote. They're saying, you know, on balance, their products help children more than they harm them and that they're taking steps to mitigate any potential harms. How do you respond to their response so far?
Well, what I can tell you is what we're seeing in classrooms. And what we're seeing is that there's a tremendous amount of anxiety and a downward spiral of mental health and well-being among young people who are the ones who are primarily using apps like Snapchat and TikTok and Meta, Instagram. And as someone who is elected to ensure the educational outcomes of students, it's incumbent upon people like me to speak up and say, we have to do something to help kids. We have to stop this harm, and we have to make sure that the companies are held liable for the harms that they've created, and that they also start to ensure that they're fixing the problems.
Could you not just ban phones entirely?
Well, we can do that during the day, and certainly the Toronto District School Board is working on a new cell phone and mobile use policy. It is something that we're talking about, but that doesn't stop the harm that's being created. As I'm sure you know, kids roll out of bed and they literally pick up their phone and they scroll TikTok or they look at Insta or all those type of things.
A lot of adults do too.
A lot of adults do too, except that adults have a prefrontal lobe that's been fully developed and children don't. That's the difference. So when we think about the impact that this is having outside of school hours, when they're not in the classroom, this is what we need to really be concerned about. We can manage some of the pieces inside the school day, but what happens the other many, many, many hours of the day when kids aren't under our care, we still have a responsibility to speak up for that.
Ontario Premier Doug Ford, you may have heard, was asked about the suit. We'll play a little bit of what he said about it.
We ban cell phones in the classroom, so I don't know what the kids are using. But I disagree with them. Let's focus on the core values of education. Let's focus on math and reading and writing. That's what we need to do. So let's focus on the kids, not about this other nonsense.
He's calling your suit, quote, other nonsense, and you heard what else he had to say there. How do you respond to the premier?
Well, you know, his opinion is his opinion, but I do believe that what we are doing is looking out for kids and looking out for their education. That's really what this lawsuit is about.
You were talking about the access that students may have at home to a phone and those platforms, of course, if their parents allow them to. I believe you have three daughters. What kinds of conversations do you have in your home?
Well, we certainly talk about the healthy use of phones, the healthy use of social media. But I have to tell you, it's really challenging. And it's not just about gatekeeping. It's about ensuring that the harms that have been created by these apps are fixed. That's really at the core of this, because if we are to actually fix the problem and hold these companies accountable, not just in terms of compensation, but also in terms of fixing these apps so that they are safer for children, that's a win. That's where you really start to see change in terms of children's behavior, children's well-being, children's achievement and success at school.
Rachel Chernus-Lynn, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Rachel Chernus-Lynn is the chair of the Toronto District School Board. She's in Toronto. We requested comment from Meta Platforms, which owns Facebook and Instagram, as well as ByteDance, which owns TikTok. We did not hear back from either before we went to air. Over a long political career in the U.S., Joe Lieberman was famous for being independent, which is to say that he found ways to work with people in both major parties and to infuriate people in both major parties. Joe Lieberman died yesterday. He was 82. He's being remembered today for some big moments, like in 2000 when he was Al Gore's running mate, becoming the first Jewish candidate on a national ticket for a major party. And in 2008, when Senator Lieberman endorsed Republican presidential candidate John McCain over Barack Obama, a dramatic reversal rarely seen in American politics. Near the end of his time in the U.S. Senate, this is how he described himself.
I have not always fit comfortably into conventional political boxes. Maybe you've noticed that. Democrat, Republican, liberal, or conservative, because I've always thought that my first responsibility is not to serve a political party, but to serve my constituents, my state, and my country, and then to work across party lines to make sure good things get done for them.
Joe Lieberman was also known for being consistently aggressive in terms of foreign policy, including most consequentially in his adamant support of the American invasion of Iraq in 2003. But before all that, Mr. Lieberman was a guest on this program. In 1995, he spoke to former host Michael Enright about the ongoing conflict in Bosnia and the bipartisan bill he worked on, hoping to help put an end to the war.
Well, the problem is that Serbian aggression and genocide have met nothing but weakness for the last 3.5 years. And it seems to me that the policy of maintaining the embargo, of trying to have the United Nations forces play some half-hearted role there, has been a failure. In the fall of Srebrenica, the ensuing horrible humanitarian tragedy with families separated just is the latest sign of that failure. So I believe that though the hour is late in Bosnia and it becomes ever more complicated to bring a just solution to the crisis, that the way to go is with the policy that President Clinton brought into office with him in 1992 but never got to carry out, which is to lift the embargo, let the Muslims, the Bosnians, have the arms with which to fight the Serbs and at least give them some pressure, some pain for what they've been doing, and to use Allied air power to strike selectively at Serbian targets to support that goal, all of which is aimed at bringing the Serbs to the peace table with the hope of accepting a reasonable truce.
That would certainly change the character and conduct of the conflict. Would that not put the United States on the side of one of the combatants in all of this, that is to say the Bosnian Muslims?
It absolutely would, and I have no hesitation to say that that's the course we should follow. It seems to me that our policy in Bosnia has failed not only for strategic reasons, but it has failed for moral reasons. And I have felt from the beginning that the problem here is the concerted and intentional Serbian aggression, complemented tragically by acts that I would consider genocidal, singling out people because of their religion or ethnicity and removing them from their homes, putting them in concentration camps. So there is in my opinion, a clear wrong party here, and it is the Serbs, and the Muslims in Bosnia, or the Bosnians generally, are the victims, and we ought to be on the side of the victims who are more right than the aggressors.
From our archives, that was then U.S. Senator Joe Lieberman speaking to Michael Enright in 1995. Joe Lieberman died yesterday. He was 82. Right now, millions of people around the world are going hungry, and a lot of people in Canada are struggling to afford food at the grocery store. But at the same time, the UN Environment Program is warning that enormous amounts of food are being wasted every day, which it calls a global tragedy. The program just released its Food Waste Index report. It says households around the world wasted over a billion meals a day in 2022. It also says that same year, 1.05 billion tons of food waste, which includes the inedible waste, was generated. Richard Swanell is the director of Impact Growth at the UK-based NGO Waste and Resources Action Programme. It worked with the UN on this report. We reached him in Chilton, England.
Richard, I know, obviously, it comes with the job for you. You have to think about waste all the time. Given that, when you look at this report and the numbers in that report, are they still staggering to you?
Yes, Neil, I think they are. I think when you're talking about 1.05 billion tons of food wasted in retail, hospitality and household, that is a staggering amount of food. And I think when it comes down to it, I start thinking about the waste across the whole supply chain. And food loss and waste across the entire supply chain is responsible for between 8 and 10% of global greenhouse gas emissions, which is just a huge amount. And if food waste was a country, it would be the third, food loss and waste was a country, it would be the third biggest emitter of greenhouse gas emissions on the planet, which is just extraordinary.
Why do you think we're not doing so much better at this stage, given the fact that there have been reports and statistics before? And on top of that, as our listeners heard in the introduction, but are certainly feeling in their everyday lives, the cost of living crisis, inflation, why is there still so much waste?
One of the critical things, I think, is that people don't realize just how much is actually being thrown away in their own home. You know, one of the things this report absolutely shows is that food waste in the household is not just a rich world problem. It also occurs in high middle income and low middle income countries. It's genuinely a global problem. And I don't think people realize just how much they throw away. When we're working with businesses, we encourage them to measure food waste. And what that does is then highlight the amount of money that can be saved, as well as the improvements in the environmental and reductions in environmental impact that can be done simply by reducing the amount of food that's thrown away and making best use of all the food you buy. And I think actually in the home, it's a similar thing. We don't realize if we just put, you know, a container on the side and put in the amount of food thrown away in the average week, it will surprise all of us. And that will show us exactly how much we could save simply by wasting less.
Are you guilty of wasting food in your house too?
It's a constant battle, Neil, that we play. We've got food waste only collections, and I've got a compost bin as well. And so I use that to keep a careful tabs on what we throw away. So we try and keep it absolutely down to a minimum. But it, you know, all the time, the two mantras in the back of my mind is, you know, buy what we need and eat what we buy.
I was going to ask you about that. Some tips that you've used that our listeners could employ if they aren't already.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm sure many of your listeners are doing many of the things I'm about to say, Neil. You know, planning before they go shopping, maybe a shopping list to make sure you buy what you need. Storage, you know, most fruit and veg are best stored in the fridge, except bananas. And they last a great deal longer if you do that. Making good use of any leftovers that you've got and getting portion sizes right are all key things that can help. So one of the things that I do, if we've got any sort of leftover bananas or apples and any other fruit, I just chuck it into a bowl and then whisk it up and make a great smoothie out of it. And of course, it's always, each smoothie tastes different because it has different ingredients.
You know, I was thinking as I prepared for this conversation, I know you say, your report says it's not just a rich country problem, food waste. But I wonder, you know, when we think about the United States and Canada, convenience is such a big part, understandably, of people's lives. They want to go grocery shopping, you know, once a week. People stockpile. They go to the big stores as well to buy things in bulk to meet their family's needs. But it's quite different than you'll see in some smaller areas or European countries where people will buy what they need for the day. That seems like a waste of time to people. But do you think that model could help as well?
Yeah, it's really interesting, Neil, because, you know, one of the striking things about that when we look at the household data is how consistent it is worldwide amongst countries. Even though there are different habits and different food cultures, it's extraordinarily consistent. I mean, Canada is actually spot on the mean at 79 kilograms per capita per year. But it does mean that the average Canadian is throwing away more food than the average human's body weight. So it is a significant amount, but it is fascinating that what we're seeing is that even in different cultures, the total amount of food waste is the same. One of the things we think might change between different societies is that there may be different levels of inedible waste within the amount we throw away. So in hotter countries where you've got much more fresh fruit and veg than is consumed in others, you may find that there's more of the inedible portion that in that's thrown away. But
that changes culturally too, right?
Exactly that. And of course, also what constitutes inedible changes from culture to culture as well.
Are there regions or countries specifically that you saw are getting it right or employing things that we elsewhere in the world could try as well?
Yes, there are. And there are countries that are actually running consumer behavior change campaigns like Love Food, Hate Waste, which is in Canada, to help encourage change. The UK, for example, right across the supply chain, has managed to reduce its food waste by 18% in total terms, and Japan's made it up to 31%. We've seen other countries actually reducing food waste in the home through using a combination of consumer behavior change campaigns, i.e., giving people hints and tips of how to make the best use of the food that they buy and minimize what is thrown away, thereby saving money and reducing their impact on the environment. And those campaigns can be extremely effective. And also it's helped by businesses sort of making it as easy as possible for people to waste less. And this could be, for example, through innovative packaging that's resealable, for example, and getting portion sizes right and helping people buy the right amount. So buying loose, for example, could be a lot easier because that means you can buy exactly the amount of broccoli you want or the amount of apples that you want. And also reduces plastic pollution as well into the bargain. Mm. So we are seeing companies and countries acting. We know in this report talks about methods that you can employ to help reduce food waste. What we now need is more people, more businesses, and more governments to prioritize this activity because it gives a great return on investment financially, socially, and environmentally.
Richard, thank you for your time.
Neil, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Take care.
Richard Swanell is with the NGO Waste and Resource Action Program. He's a contributor to the UN Environment Program's Food Waste Index Report 2024. We reached him in Chilton, England. Today in Paris, the French National Assembly voted to bar discrimination against people on the basis of their hair. The proposed legislation would prohibit unequal treatment because of hair color, texture, or style. The author of the bill is Olivier Servat, the member of the National Assembly for the Caribbean island of Guadeloupe. Mr. Servat says his proposed legislation would cover blondes and redheads, but they are not the primary group he's trying to help. We reached Olivier Servat in Paris.
Olivier Servat, the success of this bill you're sponsoring so far, what message does it send to you and others in France?
It's historical. It's the first time. It's the first time in the world that the National Assembly vote a bill to adopt a national legislative arsenal aimed specifically on combating hair-related discrimination in the workplace and public space. So I want to say that some states of United States has already voted Clone Act to fight against hair discrimination, but not the federal states of the United States. And the United Kingdom too think about that, but they don't have vote anymore this bill. So France is the first country in the world who recognize hair discrimination. It's a happiness for us.
What kinds of stories have you heard that made you want to sponsor this bill? What have people been telling you about what they experienced?
Yeah, you have to know that 60% of persons in the world don't have straight hair. They have curly hair, frizzy hair, curly hair, or frizzy hair. So it's a main problematic for a majority of people in the world. But it's not only for black people. It's for also European people, white people, blonde people, red-haired people, because all those people can have hair discrimination in your in their work, in their life. And we want to make know that they are victim of this kind of discrimination.
I'm one of those people with hair that isn't straight, but as far as I know, I haven't faced discrimination based on that fact. What about people who have faced that discrimination? What have they told you? What have black men and women in France in particular, when they're applying for jobs or in other ways in France? Because their stories are at the forefront of this bill.
Yeah, in France, a lot of people said us that in their work, as they have natural hair, the employer said that it's not a professional and they have to make straight their hair. And sometimes they have to go out at home to change their hair appearance to go on the workplace. So it's a very traumatic. It's very traumatic situation for those people, and they are happy that there is a bill, a law, who recognize this discrimination.
Let me ask: French law, as I understand it, already prohibits discrimination on the basis of appearance. So why were these cases, why were people still being, in your view, or clearly discriminated against? Why was this still allowed to happen?
Yes, it's true that French law existing on physical discrimination, but judge do not make sufficient use of this criterion of physical discrimination, because you have to know that in 2020, there is zero condemnation for physical discrimination in France. That means that this law is not really adapted to the reality of discrimination and hair discrimination.
There's been some discussion and some criticism that the word racism is not in this bill, that specific word. Why is that word not in the bill? And does it worry you that it's not?
I don't want to speak about racism because it's concern a majority of people in the world, and not only black people. All people who have frizzy hair, curly hair, and it's blonde hair, redhead hair, can have to suffer to hair discrimination. So it's not only a problem of black people. It's more large than that.
The French anthropologist Daphne Bédinade told Le Monde, and is quoted in the Guardian newspaper, quote, "To make this only about hair discrimination is to mask the problems of people whose hair makes them a target of discrimination, mostly black women," unquote. So how do you respond to her?
It's true that black people suffer more. It's the Dove study who shows that black people suffer more than white people from hair discrimination. It's true, but it's not only black people who suffer about this kind of discrimination. So my response is that it's a universal problem. I repeat the number 6. People from 10 in the world don't have straight hair. It's not only black people.
So this was just one step, political step, to getting this bill to become a law officially. It's going to the French Senate now. That could be tougher, more difficult. Do you think it's going to pass?
You know, today it's a great day. It is 1 year of fighting in the French Assembly. So now, tomorrow, I will make the work to put it reality in the Senate, the French Senate. It not will be easy, but there is nothing easy in this assembly.
Olivier Servat, thank you very much for your time.
Merci.
Olivier Servat is the member of the French National Assembly for Guadeloupe. We reached him in Paris. When Professor Scott Forbes logged into his work account at the University of Winnipeg on Monday morning, it was immediately obvious that something was wrong. He couldn't access any of his course material or student grades, and he couldn't reach the students themselves either. This week, the University of Winnipeg shut down its network and temporarily canceled classes, announcing the school had been the target of a, quote, criminal cyber attack. Classes are back in session now, and the semester has been extended a week, but the disruption came at an especially bad time as students are getting ready for exam season. Scott Forbes teaches biology. We reached him in Winnipeg.
Scott, what was class like today?
It's getting much better. We've rapidly adapted to very trying circumstances, and I've been amazed at how quickly faculty have been able to pivot on the fly to extraordinary circumstances where we've never encountered anything like this.
How have you been adapting?
Oh, well, it's been a question of getting a hold of students, mm-hmm. because if you were online, I teach several online classes, and I had lost complete contact with all of them. When our network went down, we had no way of contacting students. We needed to make course materials available for them. And it was just ingenuity all over the place, and starting to reconstruct course materials and quickly figuring out, okay, I need to find a place to stash 200 gigabytes of course material. Where do I put that? And I contacted some of our IT guys, and they came up with immediate suggestions. And they would suggest two things and say, well, this one has a steep learning curve. And, well, no, that's not going to happen. I need something which works 20 minutes from now. And so they said, suggested, okay, let's try Google Drive, and so I found a quick place to start moving materials over, and so I was up till 9:30 last night with the computer beside my bed waiting for a download to finish so I could get materials posted for my students for today.
Our listeners heard in the introduction a little bit of what started happening when you tried to log in on Monday, but when did you start really worrying?
It was Monday night when I was teaching an online class at 1 o'clock on Tuesday afternoon. And normally I send out on Sunday evening the contact for the class so they can sign in through Zoom. And I realized I had no way of contacting any students. I had no email list. First thing I did, I sent out an email at 6 a.m. on Tuesday, seeing if anybody could extract email lists, and nobody did. And then my office manager at 10:30 remembered that she had downloaded some lists and retrieved out of her downloads from months ago an email list which allowed me to start contacting students again, and came up with this brilliant idea and saved me. And so I got a half a class on Tuesday at 1, and it was much better today. I had most of my class attending.
How are the students responding?
It's a full range. Some are tearing their hair out. Some are really stressed. Others are sort of rolling with the punches.
Yeah.
I've been trying to reassure them that faculty have their backs. We'll get through this. We'll figure out a way and make it work for them.
They're stressed because apart from just being a student in general, but it's exam time, right? So are they worried about all accessing everything they need to do well?
Absolutely. Yeah, we're a week and a half away from 2 weeks away from exams, and to lose access to all of your course material all of a sudden, and it's just terribly stressful. I'm a little bit lucky because I have a son who's going to this university, so he gives me a window into the student experience. Mm-hmm. And so I've been asking him questions. Well, what do you prefer? Do you prefer a .mov format for video files or an MP4 or stuff like that, which is really helpful from my end to know the student perspective. So we're both in this together. He needs to graduate this year. And so it's a family
I can
enterprise.
Imagine. Yeah, and of course, international students are impacted as well. They'll be traveling after exams or whenever they finally happen.
Yeah, I had two come in yesterday, and they told me that they had non-refundable plane tickets for the 24th, and our exam period is going to run into early May now. And I just told him, "Don't worry, we'll make it. I'll get you on the plane if I have to drive you there myself." we'll find a way to make it work for them.
Have you heard anything from school administrators or officials about whether personal information of yours or students are at risk?
We heard yesterday that they were not aware of any that have been compromised. The details about the cyber attack are thin for obvious reasons, but they reassured us that they as of yesterday, they didn't think any had been compromised.
Do you feel that institutions, your university included, are prepared for these kinds of attacks and shutdowns? Because it's certainly not the first that we've heard.
Yeah, well, I guess we should have been paying closer attention. I'm finding out more about the Laurentian attack. One of my colleagues alerted me about what happened there. I got to think, we're sort of mid-size institutions. We have limited financial resources, and we're up against the world's best hackers. And I don't know how much you can do. And this is obviously not my area of expertise, but I got to think it's an incredible challenge. And our IT people, I know they do their damnedest to prevent this stuff from happening. But I don't, we're not the Royal Bank. Which has world-class people working constantly to defend against these kinds of peoples. We're a small institution, limited staff, limited resources. I just don't know how much you can realistically do.
What's the status of getting things back up and running online completely?
Again, not much in the way of details. The president described it as not days, more like weeks. And we're just looking at the example of the other institutions, and it was several weeks before things were back to normal. And again, we don't have any specific details, but we have our fingers crossed that things will start to restore. And there was mention that some things will come back. I'm not sure what next week.
So bit by bit, things will come back. Scott, thanks for your time.
It's my pleasure.
Scott Forbes is a biology professor at the University of Winnipeg. He's in Winnipeg. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 after Your World Tonight.
And you can, of course, also listen to our show online at cbc.ca/AIH or on the CBC Listen app, or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.